commish. And that's why I think it's a good time to learn some grammar. What? Now did I stammer? Work on that grammar, you should know it.
And good afternoon. It's midday, and today it's midday on grammar. I'm Tom Hall. If it irks you when people don't talk good, if you recoil at the sight of a misplaced apostrophe, if a missing Oxford comma sends you into an apoplectic rage, then, gentle listener, lend me your ears. My guest today is Ellen Jovan, a grammarian who has written a terrific book and who stars in a movie called Rebel with a Clause, which chronicles her experience at the Grammar Table, a one-stop pop-up in which she answers any and all questions about grammar. And Ellen is setting up the Grammar Table for the hour right here on midday today, and you are invited to join our conversation. We'll have a question or two for you, and we will take any questions that you have as well. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. And Ellen Jovan joins us on Zoom from New York. Ellen, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me back again, and I enjoyed your opening playlist.
Well, you know, that's Weird Al Yankovic, you know, does a song about grammar, and here we are at midday doing another show about grammar. It's been way too long since you were on the last time. You know, I said, we need to have Ellen on again. It must have been 6 months ago that we had, it was like two or three years ago. It was a long time ago. So
Time has flown.
Yeah, time does fly, and you've been very busy. The movie, which we talked about when you were on the first time, you know, was sort of in progress, but now it's done. And forgive me, in the opening billboard, I gave the wrong title. I said Rebel Without a Clause. That's not true. It's Rebel with a Clause.
Well, thank you. That's it took me about a year to be able to say my own book title correctly, so I sympathize with the challenge.
But of course, you know, a person in your business would never be, you know, caught without a clause. You travel with clauses, yeah.
So would be a short book and movie, yeah, without a clause.
Exactly. But you did a lot of traveling for this movie because, I mean, you visited every state to set up your grammar table. For folks who aren't hip to all that, tell us what the grammar table is.
It's a pop-up advice stand that I first set up outside my apartment building in New York City, which happens to be near an express subway stop, back in 2018, just to answer the grammar and grammar-adjacent questions of total strangers on the street.
And how did you get into the grammar business? I mean, sort of this, at the time, that wasn't your real job. I don't know if it's your completely real job now, but what's your background?
I have either taught writing and grammar or written professionally throughout my professional life. So I'm a word person. I've studied a ton of languages. I used to blog about that. So I have many words in my life. And at the time that I started the Grammar Table, I was spending way too much time in language and grammar nerd groups on Facebook, and I just wanted to be outside talking to people more.
Yeah, and you talked to a lot of people because you went from setting it up outside your apartment to setting it up in all 50 states. That's an encyclopedic project right there.
It is, but it didn't really feel like that because I just love it, and one state led to another.
Were there differences, you know, Midwest, South, Northwest, East Coast, Left Coast, Right Coast, you know, between people's understanding of grammar, people's usage, people's questions? There are different accents when we speak in different parts of the country. I mean, a person from New England sounds much different than a person from Southern Texas, generally speaking. But did you find people's questions to be different as well?
A little bit. I noticed, for me, speech in the South is the most different. The rest of the country sort of sounds, to my ear, roughly equivalent to what I grew up doing. I remember in Ohio, two different people asked if ain't was a word, and no one asked that in any other state in the country. It's not a statistically significant sample size, but I just found that funny. In the South, I did talk about y'all more. And ma'am, like how people, because I was a ma'am, there's so much more. And I found it really charming. So I had conversations about that there that I wouldn't have elsewhere.
Well, let's ask the question here. Is ain't a word? The old phrase is, you know, ain't a word because ain't in the dictionary. I mean, is ain't in the dictionary? I haven't looked it up recently.
Sure, it's in the dictionary. It's a word. It's real. So it's if it gets used, it's real.
Yeah.
It's a word.
And all sorts of things. I know one of the, because I saw the trailer of your movie. I haven't been able to see the whole movie yet. It's appearing or going to be screened in New York, I guess, next week. And looking forward to, you know, when it becomes widely available. But one person asked you where the apostrophe goes in the greeting or the I guess it's a noun, y'all. What part of speech is y'all? Y'all come
That'd
back.
That'd be a
now.
Pronoun.
A pronoun.
Pronoun.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
and we're
and they had this young guy had an argument with his friend as to whether the apostrophe goes after the Y or after the A. And I was delighted to know that the one that I thought turned out to be right. So educate us.
He was too, the Y apostrophe A-L-L. He was hilarious. Grammar, he was reminded that grammar nerds come in all formats.
What do you mean, all formats? What?
He was not what you would necessarily, he was not necessarily what you would expect of a grammar nerd. You know, he was smoking, he had a leather jacket, he was slightly profane. But he was really into language. I mean, he was into calligraphy. It was just, people surprise you. I feel as though the grammar table is as much about reminding me of the variety of human beings on the planet as it is about enjoying punctuation and conjugations.
Yeah, maybe it's a subset, you know, biker nerd or something. I don't know. It sounds good, you know.
That's right.
So folks, if you have questions or if you would like to join in and take a quiz or two, give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. And we're going to start with this question. And let me say in full disclosure right off the top, there are absolutely no fabulous prizes involved in today's show. This ain't Oprah. Yeah, that's right. It's honor. You get it. But we're not giving cars away. You know, we're you know, much as we'd like to do that, right now we're facing CPB funding cuts that, you know, giving cars away are very, very a distant aspiration. So to win the honor, the midday honor of knowing that you got a grammar question right, you can give us a call again, 410-662-8780, or email midday@wypr.org. So our first audience question is, and this comes from Ellen, if your last name is Smith and you have a wife and three kids and a mat at your front door that says the Smiths with Smith apostrophe S, so Smith apostrophe S, is your mat correct? So the welcome mat question here, on your welcome mat with the name of your family, is it apostrophe S or simply S, making it plural? Give us a call. Let us know if you get the question right. If you answer the question correctly, you will have the honor of hearing at your generation the midday bell. And I got to tell you, I like ringing the bell. So the more people who get this right, the better off I'm going to feel at the end of the day. So give us a call and let us know, do you put on the welcome mat in front of your house or in the back of your house for that matter, apostrophe S or simply S to make it plural? So I also want to ask you, Ellen, about something that I think we did talk about the last time, but I still have an obsession with this, and that is the difference between well and good. So
yeah,
if you say, hey, Ellen, how are you? Do you say, I'm well, or do you say, I'm good? And do they mean different things?
No, they don't actually mean different things because, yeah, people act as though they mean different things. The argument that I was taught when I was a kid, if you say I'm good, you mean that you're morally good and that's obnoxious to proclaim. But that's not what people mean, and convention determines meaning. I don't say I'm well. I was taught to say I'm well, and I always felt like a weirdo saying it, so I say I'm doing well. I avoid the problem, Tom. My solution to some of these things is avoidance.
An excellent answer to any number of problems. Avoidance. We can recommend that across the board for all sorts of stuff. All right, Nancy is calling from near Annapolis with an answer to the question about the welcome mat. So, Nancy, where are you on this? Are you at apostrophe S or plural S?
Plural S, unless it says the Smith home or the Smith house.
Okay, great. And Nancy, if you would give us do us a favor and turn your radio down or turn it off for just a second while you're on the air, that's great. So, Ellen, yes or no? Is it apostrophe S or plural S? Nancy is saying that if it were apostrophe S, possessive, you would have to identify what it is that the Smiths have, like the house or the yard or whatever.
Yeah, well, she's right. I figured she would be. She called in quickly. I felt optimistic about this.
All right, so first of all, before we go on, Nancy is indeed right, which means I get to ring the bell. Okay, thank you. Now I feel much
okay.
better. Congratulations,
There's
Nancy.
There's a but.
Mm-hmm. What's the
There's
but?
There's a but. Okay, the but is, so for the mat, should be the Smiths, no apostrophe. If it were the Smiths' home, I mean, that would be a weird mat to have, but let's say you had the Smiths' home, it'd be S-M-I-T-H-S apostrophe.
S so there's apostrophe, not like, yeah, because S, it's S all apostrophe. Of the Smiths' home.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
It's the plural Smiths' home. Now, Nancy.
If you had the Smith apostrophe, oh, go ahead, Tom.
Nancy, how about this one? If you were putting it on an address label, that you put on an envelope, do you put the Smiths without an apostrophe or with an apostrophe, and then the address as the return address on an envelope? What do you think? That's, in other words, not a welcome mat, but the return address on an envelope. What do you think, Nancy? Whoop, we might have lost Nancy. Nancy, are you there?
I'm there. No apostrophe needed.
No apostrophe on the address label. Okay, so on an envelope. So, Ellen, what do you think about that one?
Well, I knew Nancy was going to get this right, too. It was inevitable. And, Nancy, you are officially appointed the apostrophe consulting person in your group of friends for when holiday card season comes out.
Congratulations, Nancy. Excellent. Because I see a lot of apostrophes on holiday cards. I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nancy, that is great. You got 2 out of 2. So that's terrific. Well done. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. And Ellen, we have another caller, Chris, who's on the line from Baltimore. And Chris, welcome to the show with Ellen Jovan. We want to give you a minute to ask your question. You've got a good one, as far as my producers have told me.
Oh, thank you. Hey, good morning, Tom. Hey, Ellen. I'm so glad to finally ask the grammar authority on this, because it's something that I always think about, and I don't think I've ever gotten a good answer. But what is the difference between roll up the window and roll the window up? And which one is correct or more correct? And what is that called?
That's an excellent question, Chris. So the difference, or is there a difference, between saying roll up the window or roll the window up?
Yeah.
Is
so
this the whole preposition at the end of the sentence thing?
These are both okay. Let's see. I'm going to test this for a moment. Roll the window up. Roll up the window. I mean, I would probably instinctively, I think most of the time, go for roll up the window. But they're both correct. But what you cannot do, let's say you replace the window with it, you lose choice. So you can no longer, you can't say roll up it. Do you notice the difference? Isn't that interesting? When you replace it with a pronoun, you have to stick it in between the roll and then the particle. It's often, it's called different things, but I think that one would qualify, let me think for a moment, roll up, probably qualifies as a phrasal verb where you have a combination of a verb and then some other little word like that that creates a kind of new, a somewhat new meaning. I'd have to think that one through. But you have choice, which is what causes people problem with grammar. There are often choices.
That's a great question, Chris. Now, did you come into this question with a bias one way or the other? Do you find yourself doing it one way more than the other? Or have you always been equally confused about both?
I agree. I think it is kind of a choice thing. To me, roll the window up feels more formal to me, and roll up the window feels more kind of casual.
I don't hear that at all.
Writing a novel.
I don't think so. I don't think so. There's not a formality level difference. I think it, for me, it does sound more natural to say roll up the window. And what if it were like the green window? Roll up the green window, roll the green window up. If it gets long, maybe it gets a little weirder. I have to think through this kind of thing. It's not as absolute as some other questions. So I'm going to just leave it where I have it.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting that you're pondering something that people barely say anymore because they just press a little button, you know?
But when you press the button, it's rolling up the window.
I know, but it just doesn't even feel like, I know, it's weird though. I don't even know. I don't think I use roll up for that so much. Can you close the window? I think my verb choice has changed slightly. I'd have to audit my speech.
Close or open the window as opposed to rolling it up or down. Yeah. All right, well, thank you.
It makes me think of my grandparents' car.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate that. Question. Our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. And Ellen, you have a whole chapter in the book about ending sentences with prepositions, whether that's okay or not. Is up in that sentence, roll the window up, is it a preposition there? What part of speech is it?
It is not functioning as a preposition there. Some of those little words, up can be an adverb, it can be a preposition, it can be, I believe it's sometimes categorized as a particle. You're asking about something that I actually pay very little attention to, but they combine with words and they're sort of like fixed, you know, as a set phrase. And now I've lost track of what your question was about it.
Well, the question
usually
is,
with a preposition, you would expect an object, you know, after the preposition if it's really being used as a preposition.
So, because I mean, you know, there's the famous quote that's attributed to Churchill, who said, "I don't end sentences with prepositions," by saying, "Ending a sentence with a preposition is something up with which I will not put."
Well, The story, which may or may not be true, is that someone complained about his ending with a preposition. And then he said something like, "That is the sort of errant pedantry up with which I shall not put." So, yes, I definitely end my sentences with prepositions. English is constructed to allow that. French and Spanish are not. So people get ideas about English grammar through Latin and the Romance family, but it doesn't work the same in English. Like I would say, that's the book I was telling you about. There's nothing wrong with that. I wouldn't say that is the book about which I was telling you because I would lose all my friends.
Yeah, you would almost immediately, I think. I think that's
a good call.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back. Phil's on the line. We're going to get to Phil's question. Ellen Jovan is a co-founder of a communication skills training firm in New York called Syntaxis and the author of a book that I recommend highly for all the word nerds out there. It's called Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. And Rebel with a Clause is also the name of her new documentary film. We'll talk more grammar with Ellen Jovan after a quick break. Again, here's our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
In some big words, and words are all I have to take your heart.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, Mark Horowitz introduces the new Stephen Sondheim Archive at the Library of Congress, along with our own J. Wynn Russick. Plus, it's Midday at the Movies. Jaws is 50 years old this summer. We'll talk about it with Ann Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. So that's on the way tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Grammar. My guest is Ellen Jovin, the grammarian, author, and star of the new film Rebel with a Clause. She's joining us on Zoom with a few grammar challenges and answers to any and all of your grammatical inquiries. You can join us and join the fun, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. We got full phone lines and a full bunch of emails to try to get to. Let's start with Phil in Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Ellen Jovin.
Oh, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I would like to know about, there's a proper term, expressions ever regarding history when, for example, President Kennedy once said that Washington, D.C. was a city of northern charm and southern efficiency, instead of the opposite of what you mostly think of, you know, south being charming, north being efficient. And also, at the start of the Great Battle of Gettysburg in the Civil War, it so happened the Southern Army was in a more northerly position at the start. So they say it was the day the North came in from the South and the South came in from the North. So what do you call things like that? Is there a particular term or expression?
Oh, that's a good question, Ellen. Is that identified in any particular way, Ellen, to your knowledge?
I have absolutely no idea, but that's the kind of thing that comes up at the grammar table. And if anyone wants to weigh in, you're welcome to do that.
Yeah.
But technically, it's not really grammar. So it's sort of a little outside of my domain. Maybe a linguist knows a term for something like that.
Yeah, but that's a great question, Phil. Thank you for that call. So here's another question for our audience. If you'd like to weigh in on this, this is an age-old debate among grammarians. Should the period go inside or outside the quotation marks at the end of the following sentence? So here's the sentence. Does the period go in or out of the quotation marks? The HR professional described her boss as a, quote, profoundly dictatorial semicolon extremist, end quote. So a profoundly dictatorial semicolon extremist, period, quotation mark, or quotation mark, and period. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. If you would like to ring the bell here on Midday, call us and let us know what you think about that particular inquiry. Let's go back to the phones to Valerie, who's on the line in Ellicott City. Welcome to the show.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, you are on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, okay. Thank you. My stepfather, who has died, he was born in 1925, and he used to say things like, "That shirt looks well on you." And I have continued the practice, and I get strange looks when I say things like that. So I'm wondering, any thoughts about that?
All right. Thanks for the question. So, Ellen, I would go with, "That shirt looks good on you." How about Valerie's father-in-law, or stepfather, rather?
First of all, I'm noticing we're back at the good and well thing again.
Yeah.
We cannot escape it. But this is a new permutation, and someone wrote to me about this same question recently. So for me, that the version that you're describing with the well sounds like something I heard maybe in my childhood, possibly from older people, and that I've also read in books, but that I don't really encounter in my daily life. To me, it seems like part of the natural range of language. It probably would get edited by a modern editor just so it doesn't stick out conspicuously. But I find it charming, and I think I would like you to feel free to continue your ways if you wish to.
Yeah, good. I think you're right. It is charming. But it does seem kind of old school, and that's, you know, so maybe it is kind of a generational thing. Let's keep up with our phone calls. Let's go to Tom on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
For taking my call. My question is, in Spanish, there is a mood, a grammatical form called the subjunctive, where the speaker expresses doubt or hope or some mysterious quality for the future. And we also have that form in English, but I feel like it's disappearing. And so I'm wondering if your guest might speak about that form and whether or not it actually is not used as much as it was in the past. So, for instance, yeah, the sentence would be, I hope that they may return, instead of I hope that they will return, or I hope that they return.
Would you actually say may there? That sounds not very standard to me. I have another example. How about if I give you an example of what gets categorized as subjunctive in English? And I would just like to say I'm a huge subjunctive lover in other languages, and I have a whole book on Spanish subjunctive on the bookshelf behind me while we are speaking right now. So in general, the places that you might hear this kind of thing in English are when you have a counterfactual statement. For example, if I were taller, I would reach the rice for you, you know, off the top shelf. So I would normally with I conjugate it with was, but were, you know, there you see that form. If I were taller, if I were older, if I were younger. So a counterfactual takes a special form. Sometimes, a lot of times English speakers don't use that. The meaning is still clear. So it's not really critical for meaning. It's just sort of what people prefer. Then the other one is, I insist he go to the meeting. Some people will say goes there, but in that structure, the insist affects the verb that follows, so that instead of saying he goes, a lot of people will still say he go, but it sounds a little formal, so that also doesn't really get used so much. But I am a heavy subjunctive user, so if anyone ever wants subjunctive in English, just have a chat with me.
All right, well, thank you for that question, Tom. That's a good one. So that's interesting, Ellen, because I always thought for some reason that the subjunctive always takes the plural. So if I were a rich man, you know, rather than if I was a rich man, that it's like the gerund always takes the possessive, right?
Wait, I am saying, but if I were, I'm doing
right.
The same thing you,
right? Right. Yeah. But I always thought it was all the time. You said that you seemed to indicate that maybe there were times where it wasn't the case. I was a maximalist.
I'm just
on
saying
that
what people do. What people do mm-hmm. in speech. It's really common to hear people just say, "If I was older, if I was taller." In carefully edited writing, that stuff still gets changed often, but it's just very common not to do that. And it will continue to be. And maybe when we're all dead, no one will be saying if I were anymore.
Well, that's true, because we won't be. but the other one is like gerunds. Don't they always take the possessive? I appreciate your giving me that book, as opposed to I appreciate you giving me that book. The giving,
that also,
the gerund.
Yeah, these things are almost always more complicated than the general impression suggests. So I have found that educated British English speakers often do not use the possessive before gerunds in a way that sounds odd to my American English ear. But the other thing is, not everything is a gerund. So an ing form, what if I did this? He filmed me doing a cartwheel, or he filmed my doing a cartwheel? What would you say?
I would say he filmed my doing a cartwheel.
Are you sure you would, though? If we just followed you around casually with a camera and a
yes, because I'm a...
Are you sure?
I really am pretty sure, because, and even if it sounds weird, but I have this thing about the gerund always takes the possessive. So I would always...
Okay, but I don't think it's a gerund there. So ing forms can be two things. They can be gerunds, which means an ing form acting as a noun, or they can just be present participles. So in that case, he filmed me. What I'm perceiving there is me as the direct object, and then doing a cartwheel is an adjectival participial phrase modifying the pronoun, the object form of the pronoun me. So there are cases like that where it's really not acting as a gerund, and we could debate that one. But I think probably in natural speech, 99% of people would say me in that sentence.
Yeah, you're probably right. And you make a really good case for a couple of things that I couldn't describe or define if I had to on my own, like the participial stuff, you know. But you're right. It does sound weird to say my in that sentence. But, you know, as you said, you talk to educated British people who sometimes break that rule. And I've been called a lot of things. I've never been called educated or British. So, you know, that would be new for me in both cases. All right. Well, thank you, Tom, for that question. I appreciate it. Let's go to Jane in Queen Anne's County. Jane, you want to answer our question. Does the period go inside or outside the quotation marks? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think it would go outside the quotation marks because I think you only use it inside the quotation mark if it's someone actually speaking a sentence. But if you're just quoting a part of a sentence, I think the period should go outside of that quotation.
All right, Ellen, there's an argument for it outside the quotation marks. What do you think?
That is completely logical as an answer, and I have a lot of sympathy with it. It's just not the convention in the U.S. It is, however, how it works in the U.K., so if you move to London, you will be right.
So in British English, it's outside the quotation marks, because this is another sort of maximalist dictate that I always thought held true all the time, that it always goes inside the quotation marks. That's not necessarily true, huh?
No, it's an American English convention to put commas and periods inside all the time. But in British English, you see more variety. If it's just a quoted phrase at the end of the sentence, you'll see the period outside. It's more logical there. I mean, I would like to do it that way because I spend a lot of time trying to teach people something that seems unnatural to them in the U.S., mm-hmm. you know, to put them inside. Just to clarify one thing, though, question marks and exclamation marks, those are those work more as your caller described, where you would base it on whether the quote is part of the question or the question is itself a quote. So those two are logical. Periods and commas are just always inside.
All right. Well, Jane, thank you very much. That's a great try, you know, but we're going to go with the American standard for the moment here on Midday, but I appreciate the call. Ellen Jovan is my guest. It's Midday on Grammar. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wipr.org. So Ellen, we have an email from a listener, Shirley, who says, why are Apple phones correcting you and I to you and me? Of course, it depends on the sentence that it's used in, I guess, but I evidently Shirley gets that autocorrect a lot. So You and I, which is a great song by Stevie Wonder, among other things, and You and Me, how do we discern the difference?
Okay. I have an iPhone and I've never had that corrected for me in a way that I found incorrect. But you and I that's the subject. You is the subject and the object form, so that's not a very good explanation. But you and I would be in the subject position. For example, you and I visited the grammar table. You and me would be the object. The grammar table fell on you and me. That's sort of a tragic outcome there. But it's. But I would like if that person wants to message a sentence, that would be really helpful. Because I'm curious now about whether something's being miscorrected. I doubt it, though. I doubt that's happening.
All right. Well, Shirley, if you want to email us a specific example, that would be great. Micah sends an email with a little bit of a pet peeve of Micah. People graduate from school. They do not graduate schools because schools cannot graduate. Micah says that drives me nuts. So you say, okay, I graduated from the Ellen Jovan School of Grammar, rather than I graduated Ellen Jovan School of Grammar. That makes sense to me. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say I graduate. But people do say, I graduated high school. You know,
yeah.
I graduated college.
It's just part of the general evolution of language. I mean, we use words all the time that came to us with different meanings in their original forms, and that, you know, the grammar surrounding them has changed, and we just don't notice it because it's been that way our whole life. The graduated from thing, if you look at older newspapers, you can find she was graduated from. So people were actually taught at one point to say she was graduated from. No one wants to say that now. I was taught very strictly to say graduated from. That was a big deal. But why, you know, it's just we agree on these conventions of sounds to mean certain things. It's obviously in use as without the from. So graduated high school. It's a thing. I wouldn't do it in formal writing, but it really doesn't bother me anymore. And I find not worrying about that kind of stuff, which is ubiquitous, is very relaxing.
Yeah. Again, not worrying, forgetting all about it. These are excellent, excellent life lessons from Ellen Jovan, who is the star of a new documentary film called Rebel with a Clause. That's also the name of a book she wrote a few years ago. It's terrific. We'll have more grammar challenges on the other side of a quick break. You can join us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email midday@wypr.org. I'm Tom Hall. We will be right back.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on Grammar. Ellen Jovan is with us until the top of the hour. She is the author of a terrific book and a new movie called Rebel with a Clause. In 2018, she set up the grammar table in a little park across from her apartment building in Manhattan. She answered people's questions about grammar, which she has studied and taught for years. The movie follows her journey setting up her grammar table in every state in the union. Ellen Jovan has set up the grammar table today for us here on Midday, and you are welcome to pose a question or answer a question that we ask you. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So listeners, here's our next listener question. What part of speech, in other words, is it a noun, verb, adjective, adverb, pronoun, conjunction, whatever, is the following word? Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. All right. So supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Now, let me tell you, remind you where it appears in the song from The Sound of Music. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. So, is that a noun, a verb, an adjective, an adverb? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or email midday@wypr.org. And Ellen, we're going to go back to the phones. We have Dave on the line, who wants to talk about something that a few other people have emailed about, the Oxford comma. Welcome, Dave. What's on your mind when it comes to commas?
Well, using the Oxford comma or not, I happen to not like using it in many cases, but I think there may be situations where it is appropriate, but I think I'm in violation of the general rule when I opt not to use it. Is there a hard and fast rule about using it or not?
Okay, Ellen, let's start by reminding folks what the Oxford comma is.
Yeah, so the Oxford comma is often, it goes by different names. It's also called the serial comma, S-E-R-I-A-L, and it's the comma before the and, before the last item in the list. Some people use it, some people don't. It's Associated Press style, which governs a lot of what you see in newspapers, not to use it unless it's necessary for clarity in books. You know, like if you follow something called the Chicago Manual of Style, which affects a lot of publishing, you will more often see that comma included. It's not right or wrong. People do different things. What I do find is that the abstainers are sometimes absolutists in a way that I don't support. For example, if I said I ordered salad, comma, spaghetti and meatballs and soda. If I were a non-spaghetti and meatballs as a single element, but it has an and in it, in that case, I would go use the Oxford comma, whether you normally do or not, put it after the meatballs and it will be easier to read. That's not inconsistent. It's just being practical for the sake of clarity and using it when it's needed.
All right. That's a very articulate duck of the question, Ellen. I agree, and I appreciate it. That's terrific.
That is an unfair assessment. I reject that.
And you're right. You're right again, of course, of course. Let's go to, I mean, I'm just used to, I interview a lot of people who hold public office. I'm used to duckers. You know, it just happens in this business. Elaine is on the line in Baltimore, and you've been very patient. Thank you so much. What's on your mind?
Well, your question about the welcome mat reminded me of a dilemma I have a lot. When you write something like, this school is a boys' school or it's a girls' school, does that get an apostrophe?
Oh, great question.
Yeah, those are really difficult, and you do see some variety on that. What was my last? I spent about an hour dealing with this a year ago. I went to a girls' school, and I usually do by default girls' apostrophe school, but I don't think that's really necessary. You do sometimes see that. I would have to think about this more and really consider it when I'm not on the air under time pressure. But you can argue that the noun is just descriptive in front of it and not a possessive form. Do you have a preference?
I do not like the apostrophe.
Yeah, I mean,
a description of what kind of school it is.
Yeah, a girls' school. Yeah, maybe that's where I ended up. I would have to think about it. There's a lot of there are a lot of ambiguous answers at the grammar table, and I do want to point out one thing while we're on the subject of ambiguous answers. One thing that causes a lot of trouble in discussions of public discussions of grammar is that across generations, people have been taught different categories for things like, you know, roll up the window. I was taught to understand that in a particular way grammatically that's not really conventional now. So often you have these clashes where people aren't necessarily disagreeing about the grammar, but they're disagreeing about the vocabulary that they use to describe the grammar. And it makes it very challenging, actually. Don't talk about clauses online. It just won't go well.
It won't go well indeed. Well, thank you, Elaine. That's a great question. And for what it's worth, I'm with you. I would not use the possessive there. I would not use the apostrophe. But it's a really, really great question because we have a lot of great questions from our great listeners. So, Ellen, here's one, an email from Jean in Ellicott City. Do you use or you use the word between if you're talking about two items? So it's between the left and the right. But if it's greater than two, do you use the term among? So is it between the left, the right, the top, the bottom, the top and the bottom? Or is it among the left, the right, the top and the bottom? When you have four things instead of two things, does that dictate what you use between the words between and among?
I was taught this idea, use between with two, use among with more, but it doesn't always work to use among with more. You often want, even if you have four items or five items, you're often really considering the space or the relationship between two at a time in that larger set, and it just doesn't sound natural or idiomatic. I also think this is one of those rules that was passed on by someone who maybe said something in passing or wrote something in passing, and it got institutionalized as a kind of language law that doesn't really correspond to what our instincts are with a given situation. So guess what? it's another, you know, mushy answer. That's life.
Yep, that is life. An Instagram listener says, how do we use the dash appropriately? And this person says, I use it as a pause in sentences. So we have dashes and hyphens. Are they the same thing? And how do you use them appropriately?
Dash is often used incorrectly to refer to hyphens. So hyphens are the really short little things that you see at the ends of lines when words are broken, or if you have something like a first-rate actor, you would have hyphen, a little tiny short thing. It's the keyboard on the upper right corner of your keyboard. You press that and you combine first-rate into a kind of a glued together adjective. The dash is the punctuation. It's longer. And it is often used, I use it for a dramatic pause. For example, the fire destroyed their house, their car, and all their belongings, dash, but it could not destroy their innate optimism. I would normally use a comma there before the but the dash kind of, you know, is like ta-da. I wouldn't use it just as a random substitute for periods because you don't feel like ending your sentence. So there has to be something going on. I also use two. I use a pair. For example, my boss just got a raise, dash, her first in 40 years, dash, and promptly bought a condo. So it's like a descriptive phrase that's set aside. Beware the overuse of the dash because it's kind of like the boy who cried wolf. It saps it of its excitement and no one listens to you anymore.
Yeah, and those are really great examples because the dash doesn't make it does make it more dramatic. I mean, and when you're reading it, you see it as a separate thing. The clause really, sort of pops out at you. So now, of course, if we do a grammar show, Ellen, we couldn't have a grammar show without a question about who and whom. So this is Elizabeth, Evelyn Elizabeth, who writes in from Dundalk. Give it to whomever wants it, thinking that whomever is the object of to, but they don't know that whomever is the subject of the dependent clause and should be whoever. And Evelyn Elizabeth says it's similar to the order of operations in algebra. Parse the dependent clause separately, and when in doubt, avoid whom. It's better to be wrong than to be simultaneously wrong and pretentious. That's cute.
I love everything about that.
Yeah.
Everything that person just said, I agree with 100%, and I would like to be friends with you.
Okay, so it's not give it to whomever wants it. It's give it to whoever wants it. Right. So
it is the subject of that. The whole clause is the object of two, not just the word who or whomever. So she's absolutely right.
Okay, so Evelyn Elizabeth, whoever you are, you have a new friend in Ellen Jovan. Very good. All right, we got a few minutes left. Not very many. Let's do Jackie in Baltimore. Jackie, real quick question because we're almost out of time. What's on your mind?
From and off. I got it off my friend. This annoys me enormously. Did I get it from that person or did I get it off this person?
All right, direct question there. Ellen, what do you think?
So the question is it get I got it from my friend or I got it off my friend?
Yes.
Meaning like a gift or something?
Yes.
I mean, I have heard off my friend in casual conversation. That wouldn't be what I would do in writing or actually in my own speech. So that I assume your caller wants from there.
Yeah. That's my assumption too.
And unfortunately, I support
we don't we don't have enough time to check in with Jackie, but Jackie and everybody else who called and emailed and Instagrammed, we are grateful. And Ellen, we are grateful to you. Ellen Jovan, the book is called Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian, and the movie is simply called Rebel with a Clause. Thanks, Ellen. This is so much fun, and we will have you back much sooner than the last interregnum that we suffered through in between appearances. Okay.
Thanks for letting me conjugate verbs on your show.
There you go. Always fun conjugating with you, Ellen. Thank you so much. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies. Coming up now, it's Fresh Air. The author and poet Lila Motley is the guest. I'm Tom Hall. And with us, have a great day.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.